Colonel Brett's Rule 3. You've told me a great deal about the type of training and preparations and attention which was given to the Northwest frontier. But of course, when it came to the Second World War, you got the attack by Japan through the Northeast frontier. Whilst you were a soldier, an officer in India in the 1930s, did you and the other officers there ever think that anything of that kind might happen, that there might be any trouble of that kind from the northeast rather than from the northwest?
No, I never heard it discussed, and certainly I hadn't thought of it. Not that I was a person of any very great knowledge that way. And even later, when I was at the senior officer school at Belgaum, we never discussed an invasion from the northeast. The northwest had always been rather in the forefront of the minds of the Indian governors and soldiers because of the possibility of Russia coming through Afghanistan and heading into India in that direction. That, after all, was the historic route into India. Alexander the Great came across Persia and Afghanistan and invaded India from that direction. And it seemed a more likely area of assault than the northeast. Of course, the Japanese upset a good many of our prognostications in the Second World War. And undoubtedly, India will be thinking more about her northeast frontier in the future than we ever did. Of course, the area where I was so much is now Pakistan, which is rather different from India. It was mainly high country, highlands and mountainous, and it always had that threat, the possibility of a threat through the Khyber Pass.
When did you go to this senior officer's school at Belgaum?
Oh, not till the end of my service in India. I went there in about April 1939. And I was there until the beginning of July. While I was there, I was told that I was to receive accelerated promotion to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, and I could go at once to come home, but I thought I'd like to finish the course, and I got permission to do so, and stayed there until the 1st of July.
How useful did you find the course?
Oh, very useful indeed. It taught one how to think in a regular sequence and to pass out your instructions and your orders in a regular sequence so that you miss nothing and those to whom you are conveying the orders got them in a regular sequence from which they might be able to pass on your orders correctly and the way you intended them to be obeyed. There wasn't a great deal of tactical discussion, that's to say, strategical discussion. That's to say, talking about fighting any of the forces other than Germany. We were pretty close to the Second World War, and we were therefore talking and thinking to some extent about that, but in no great detail, and certainly not as it affected us as in India.
How long before the Second World War did you really begin to think that you'd have to fight Germany?
Oh, I think I anticipated it, and most others did, during 1938, after Chamberlain's visit to Hitler. It seemed a certainty that war would come.
And when you went on this course to Belgorm, how many men were there taking the course whilst you were there?
There were about 30 other students. Our commandant became a very famous man. The commandant was then Brigadier William Slim, who afterwards became Field Marshal Lord Slim, the fighter of the Burma campaign. A very great general and a very fine man.
And did you leave your family behind when you went on the course, or did they go with you to South India?
Did I?
Did your family go with you?
No,
to
my family had already gone home. My family went home in December 1936, shortly before I went up and on that campaign in 1937 in Waziristan. And so they were at home during those couple of years.
Was this the only time you went to South India when you went on to Belgorm?
That was practically the only time I was in South India, yes. I had spent a fortnight or so at Ambala and again in Delhi, which are much more central India than South, with friends. One with the officer commanding the East Lancashire Regiment and the other with a friend in the Indian Army who was on the Viceregal staff at Delhi. And it was while I was with him that we went to a Viceregal ball, which was a most impressive affair.
Why was it so impressive?
Well, that everybody was in first-class uniform. All the men, I mean, were in their full-dress uniforms, as they would be from their various regiments. The ladies were all wonderfully dressed, too. And it was a very impressive affair.
Did you meet the Viceroy and the Vicegerent?
Oh, yes, I met them both. And I shall never forget seeing them going up to bed at 12 o'clock, when they were quiet, just in their own way, informing the party that it was coming to an end. They were going up the staircase, preceded by two of their equerries, in a light blue uniform, each carrying a silver candlestick with a lighted candle, and followed by two more equerries dressed similarly, and each again holding a candlestick, a lighted candle stick in a silver lighted candle in a silver candlestick. As the Viceroy was passing me going up the stairs, he gave me one of the most wonderful winks I've ever had in my life.
Who was the Viceroy at the time?
The Viceroy was Lord Linlithgow.
What impression did you get of Lord Linlithgow and Lady Linlithgow?
They were very... well, I suppose the best way to describe it would be they seemed to fit the part of Viceroy and Vicereine extremely well. Very dignified, and just playing the part extremely well.
Coming back to Belgorm, did you find South India very different in any way to the north, or was it much the same?
It was very much the same, except that the climate was, of course, very much hotter than we got around Rawalpindi. One very seldom put on anything in the way of warm clothing, even in the evening. And it was very hot indeed during the day, especially when we were working out in the sun. A party of us once went down to a seaside place called Vengoorla, which was really in what was then Portuguese Goa. And we had a day there mainly spent in the water, swimming about and keeping cool that way. A picnic party, just one carload of us.
And did you see any difference in the people at all?
No, the people were much the same. They were really a much darker race than those we had seen up on the frontier. But they were just as respectful. One didn't come in close contact with them any more than you did with them up in the north. I'm afraid we British were always rather far too snobbish so far as Indians were concerned. And we in British regiments very seldom met Indians other than our own servants or the tradesmen. Whether anybody ever met any real Indian civilians, I don't know. I never did, bar our regimental printer. And he invited me and my family one day to tea at his house. He came to meet us in his car and conveyed us through the tortuous, winding, narrow streets of Rawalpindi till we thought we were heading for an extremely dirty-looking slum. But when we arrived at his house, it was in a quiet, still very narrow street. What would have happened if another car had been coming along? I don't know. But we arrived at his gateway, which was promptly opened by someone inside, and he drove through, and we all alighted. And his family, his mother-in-law, his wife, and all his children, ranging from about 15 to 5, about 6 or 8 of them, were gathered there in a line to greet us. And we solemnly shook hands with every one of them and said something which we hoped they understood to be friendly remark, and they gave each of us a very friendly salaam and a smile. We were then taken inside the house, which was most beautifully clean. You couldn't have found a speck of dust anywhere. It even took us into their bedroom, where we saw how one could sleep coolly in this extremely hot city. And that is, their beds were slung from the ceiling by long steel rods, so that the bed itself, when you got into it, you could give it a push from the floor and it would remain swinging probably through most of the night, thereby providing you with air, and yet without having a draft such as you might get if you'd had the more customary punkah-wallah, waving the usual huge fan into the room. We then sat down to tea, and here our host and his brother were the only people with us. The ladies of the family and the children had all disappeared quietly, and we didn't hear a sound from any of them. And they gave us a most delicious tea with most wonderful sweet cakes and things of that sort, and there we were. When we eventually thanked them for this tea and departed, there was the usual very polite salaams, and we shook hands with everybody we could see, and off we went. But that was our only contact with an Indian family. They were Parsis, which is a different religion from either the Hindu or the Mohammedan.
Didn't you say that after the meal, the Indian custom of belching was indulged in?
After the meal, the two men both belched in the most satisfactory style, that being the Indian method of showing complete satisfaction with the meal. I think if we'd only been able to belch ourselves, we should have crowned the party with the greatest success, but none of us could. I remember my daughter doing her best to stifle her laughter.
And was this the only occasion when you went into an Indian's home?
That was the only occasion on which I went into any Indian establishment, any Indian house or hut.
And did you make any friends any Indian friends apart from this Parsi?
No. Whether this rather cool method of coping with the Indians occurred also with the Indian, with officers of the Indian Army, I don't know. With the British officers of the Indian Army, I mean. I don't know. But British officers in the British service very seldom had an occasion to meet Indian officers, except very occasionally a senior officer might meet an Indian civilian who happened to be a government official of some sort at some government party. But I cannot think of any other occasion when one could mix on friendly terms with an Indian family. When I was an abbot of Bad, the district commissioner there happened to be an Indian, and therefore he was a member of the British Army Club. Well, when I say Army Club, it was the club in the town, but there were no other British civilians there other than the soldiers, the officers, and therefore it was a British Army Club. But he was the only civilian that I met that way on terms, on friendly terms, although we never met outside the club. I do remember while I was, I happened to be a member of the committee of the Rawalpindi Club, and I'd been asked by my commanding officer to bring up the point about the admission of Indian officers who were attached to us, to make them members of the club. And I brought up this point, and it was turned down completely. Now, Indian officers were attached to a British regiment for a year after they'd been commissioned from Sandhurst. These were King's commissioned officers with the same rank and privileges at home as we who are serving in our British regiments. And they were attached to us for a year of instruction. And we felt that they, being members of our officers' mess, ought to be members of our club. But the officers who happened to be on the committee of the club would not have them. They explained to me the differences in religion and the and that sort of thing, but they were very firm on the point. And therefore, we could not bring these officers down, although I explained that they were good at games, they played tennis and all that sort of thing, but the club just wouldn't have them. We couldn't force them in, and that was that. Now, it was very unpleasant in a way, but we had to explain it to these Indian officers that they couldn't be. I don't know how it was done, because I wasn't there, but the commanding officer must have seen them and told them as tactfully as he possibly could. But nevertheless, that was one of these extremely unpleasant things which we in the British service had to face. Now, as I said, these officers were... We were very lucky in that the first two who came to us were absolutely first-class fellows. When he had commanded his platoon for a short time, put it in, like all the other platoons in the battalion, for the inter-platoon contest to find the best platoon in the battalion, and he won it. Now, from that time onwards, he was sine qua non amongst all the officers. The other chap was an absolutely first-class hockey player, and he led our hockey team to victory amongst all the other teams in Rawalpindi. He also became a sine qua non in the regiment. And we were extremely sorry when their year was up and they both went. I remember shortly after they joined that the commanding officer assembled all the company commanders one day and said he was sorry to notice that the men were not saluting these Indian officers as they should. And we were to take steps about it and warn our men that they must salute these Indian officers just as they saluted the British officers. And I remember parading my company, or seeing my company on their pay parade, which was the one day you could be certain that every man would be there. And it was a huge company, the headquarters. There were some 250 men in it. And I spoke to them rather briefly, but I could feel a little sort of snigger going along the ranks. We're bothered if we will, but we must obey Captain Britt. But only very shortly after that, certainly just after these two officers had made their mark, one in the hockey and the other having the best platoon, there was no question about it. Every man in the battalion treated those officers exactly as they treated the rest of us. So it's really dependent upon the man. If he was a first-class man, he was treated with the respect that he should have. And we were very lucky in that the first two Indian officers we got were absolutely first class and made the pace for all their many successors in succeeding years. But I must say that we never once got a poor Indian officer. I remember when we were up on the frontier in 1937, we actually had a Pathan officer attached to us. Now, he belonged to these very people that we were fighting. And he was invaluable in that he knew the language, he knew their habits, and he could act as a go-between. And he did his duty valuably that way. And in his own way, I expect he helped to bring peace to amongst the tribes sooner than might have been expected.
And was he loyal?
He was very loyal in every possible way. It must have been difficult for him, but he knew that they were bound to lose in the end. And he knew the value of cooperating with the British, because it meant such a lot to them. As I wrote an account of that campaign in later years, which I published in our book, and I find that we paid allowances to the tribes while on good behavior, and in return expected them to maintain the military roads in good order and to police them. The political administration did much to help, but the tribesmen's innate objection to anything savoring of control and his strong religious prejudices intended to keep him backward. Nevertheless, it was not uncommon in peaceful times for tribesmen to visit cantonments such as Kohat and Banu by bus, park their rifles and knives at the police post, receiving tickets in exchange, do their shopping and go to the cinema, and in due course redeem their weapons, catch their buses and go peacefully home. That is an extract from the regimental history which I wrote, sometime after the war. That is the history of the South Wales Borders and Mamershire Regiment, Part 1. Military operations were hampered in that there was no strategic objective to the seizure of which would compel the enemies to surrender, and seldom a formed body which could be met and defeated. If the recalcitrant leaders could have been captured, operations would have ended speedily, but finding a needle like the Fakir of Ypres in a haystack like Waziristan was a task which failed of accomplishment. Operations therefore tended to become little more than a military occupation of the country with an occasional raid or gush in the hope of capturing someone of importance or of inducing the tribesmen to attack in conditions less favorable to themselves than they might think.
When was this campaign?
This campaign was in 1937. We moved up there in February and returned in December.
And were you told beforehand much detail about the political purpose of what you were doing and the cause of the trouble?
Well, we knew that the Fakir of Ypres was a very troublesome man and that he was stirring up the tribes, doing his best to get a full stage revolt going. In actual practice, a good many of the tribes did that, though the older men were sensible and tried to hold back the youngers, but they did not have sufficient influence over them. The older men liked receiving their pay and keeping the peace and guarding the roads, but they had no control over the younger men and the Fakir of Ypres, and hence the trouble developed.
And on this particular campaign, how many men were involved from the government forces?
Well, there was usually one brigade in garrison at Rusmuk. Our brigade then went up, and shortly afterwards, the second brigade came from Rawalpindi to join us. So there was practically a whole division, somewhere about 12,000 to 15,000 men, including the artillery and the ancillary troops, engaged in this campaign.
And apart from the South Wales Borderers, which British regiments were involved?
The Argylls were there. They were in the 2nd Brigade. And I think it was the Dorsets were in the 3rd Brigade. The other two brigades were mainly Indian troops, not Gurkhas like ours.
And how much action was there? How much shooting?
There was a considerable amount. It varied, of course, according to the with each brigade. Our brigade first came into action at a place called Dumdale, when one of the Gurkha battalions was ambushed as it was leaving camp to picket the roads. They were going in one north of our camp, and we happened to be sent out on duty picketing south of the camp, and so we didn't hear of the raiding except the sound of the guns firing until we came back about noon, when those vehicles we'd been guarding had passed into our camp. But when we arrived at noon, we found that we heard about this battalion of the Gurkhas having been ambushed, and in the afternoon, my company and two more, the C Company, I was B Company, C Company and the Machine Gun Company, were sent out to help one of the Gurkha battalions to get back. They'd been sent out to assist the 1st 6th Battalion, which had been involved in the ambush. They'd managed the 1st 6th itself, with the aid of this battalion, managed to recover its dead and wounded, and they'd got back into camp. But now the 2nd 5th Battalion, which had gone to cover them, was threatened by a large force of tribesmen who were known to be hidden in some dead country. And we went out to assist them to get back. We didn't actually get into action, but the mere fact that they were there helped the 2nd 5th Battalion to get back. When they were safely back, we were then withdrawn, my company being the last in.